we wanted to introduce and welcome Kevin Anderson today. He's been generous enough to come by and visit with us. And of course, we're talking about the BlackBerry litigation that everyone knows about, I'm sure, by now. And it was amazing how difficult it was to get somebody to come down to talk to us. Unfortunately, I think we were talking to the BlackBerry people first, and I can't blame him for not wanting to brag about how it ended up for them. But fellow Arizona State alum, I'm excited about that, so welcome him. And graduated from George Washington.
Duke
Law School. Sorry. But welcome from Wiley Rhining Fielding. So, welcome.
Great. We can do this however you want. Feel free to interrupt me with questions if you have. And the first person that calls me Mr. Anderson, I swear you're out of here. Because Mr. Anderson's my dad. I'm kidding. I just had a few comments. I'll go through a few slides here. And I have a couple short videos, which I'm sure you will find of interest because they mesmerize our summer associate class every year. So, but like I said, feel free to ask me questions either before or during or after. So, the case, BlackBerry case, renowned. I can't tell you how much press contact we finally had to hire press people to do that, because there were days where I just spent on the phone with the Wall Street Journal and New York Times the whole day. It was just really impeding our ability to do the case. So I'll go through a little background here. NTP, the plaintiff, probably not very many people know about him. There's a guy named Tom Campana who was just a little inventor. And he got out of the military about 1970, and he started building wireless systems. Sold a lot to, like, the Chicago Police Department. And over the years, just developed a lot of interesting little gadgets and got about 50, 55 patents. And the ones of most renowned or notoriety, depending upon your side, were these 8 patents that he got that covered wireless email. And these came out of an effort back in about 1990, 1991. He had a nationwide wireless data system that he was working with. And he was looking around for uses for that because people weren't going to pay for just paging, or at least not enough. And he stumbled on the idea of putting together email because that was kind of in its infancy then, at least widespread use. And he put together the two systems, and by October 1990, he had a nationwide wireless email system working. Now, unfortunately, in 1991, as was frequent back then, his wireless carrier went bankrupt. And he was just out. He lost a significant amount of money himself. And he basically scaled back his little company that he had back in Chicago to just a few employees. But one thing that he did pursue was the patent applications that he'd submitted. And over the course of the next few years, those patent applications evolved into patents. And we'll get to that in just a second. Okay, RIM, probably most people know them. They're actually a fairly old company. Founded in 1984. They started selling BlackBerry stuff in 1999. And their CEO and founder, Mike Lazaridis, whom you're going to see a video of, has been referred to as the Bill Gates of Canada. And I don't know if you see it down here, but definitely up in Canada, he's on one of those American Express ads like Coach K. You can go to their website, American Express website, I think, and watch it. Or at least you can Google it, and I know you can find it there. I'll just kind of hop to the meat of the litigation without going to very many of the boring details. It was patent case and standard patent stuff. And RIM's defenses throughout the litigation, some of them were a little hard to believe, especially this first one, and that's one you're going to see the video on, is for 90% of the time up until trial. And the trial was just enrichment. Judge Spencer down there. they said blackberries don't do email. And it's a very strange defense, very, very strange defense, because finally on the stand, we got Mr. Lazaridis to admit they do email, because we had that day's Wall Street Journal, which had a two-page ad saying, stay on top of your email with BlackBerry. And so eventually we wore him down on that one. That was a tough one. And then there's always kind of nuances about claim language, which I won't bore you with the detail there, but in any patent case, there's always a big stink over, you know, what the patentee meant by the most minor language in their claim. And ultimately that gets resolved by the Federal Circuit in most instances. Here they had a few nitpicks there that didn't get them anywhere. Finally, their third defense is the one that this case is probably going to be known for, at least in legal terms, for a while, is the extraterritoriality defense. And I make fun of them a little bit here. What they really were saying, at least from our perspective, is that we're Canadians, so that, you know, we're immune to U.S. patent laws. And the reason that is, this defense was based on, was the BlackBerry system. Probably not very many of you know it. And here's one of the trial exhibit handhelds. Unfortunately, I didn't charge it up, but I don't have the service turned on anyway. When you send or receive an email with this, it goes to your wireless tower, goes to and from your wireless tower, your wireless carrier here, and then in the middle is what RIM calls now a Networks Operations Center up in Canada. So every email that you send or receive from your BlackBerry goes through Waterloo, Canada, an operations center. And some of the claims had language that referenced that operations center. So RIM's defense was, because your language mentions an interface, which is what it was called in the claims, and that interface is up in Canada, you can't apply the law, patent laws, to actions outside the U.S. Not a normal defense. It stemmed from a case back in 1970-71 called Deep South. And in that case, what had happened is there was a U.S. patent on a particular machine, and the accused party got around it by building all of the components in the U.S. and then shipping it to like Brazil, I think it was, and saying, okay, you assemble it down there and use it down there. And it went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, yeah, that's fine, because the actual invention, which was the system, not the components, wasn't made in the U.S., and they didn't consider the other, the cell and the use prongs, but it wasn't made until it was assembled into a functioning whole outside. And we never could really get quite that strong of an argument. They mostly just wanted to quote out of context lots of U.S. cases where it said, you know, you can't apply U.S. laws overseas. But this is the issue that they ultimately tried to take up to the Supreme Court, and it didn't go very well for them. And we'll talk about that in a second here. Now, the trial was, like I mentioned, was in Richmond, November 2002, and RIM tried, their lawyers tried every single defense that's in the book. You can go get the Chisholm treatise on patent law, and you can look under defenses, and that was pretty much their, you know, just checklist down there, which doesn't always turn out to be very effective, because the wheat kind of gets lost in the chaff, and that's what happened there. They had this really interesting demonstration of prior art, which was probably the turning point in the whole case. And what they did was went out and identified this system that they thought was in existence back in 1990. And they hired the people that worked on it as their consultants, which didn't turn out very well. And they went out to eBay and other places on the internet and bought a whole bunch of equipment from back then. And right before trial, the parties are exchanging this pretrial exchange of demonstratives. Because most of the time, you know, you've exchanged everything during discovery, but you have demonstratives that you can try and prove your case in front of the jury. And a lot of times you just exchange those before trial, so there's no surprise. This was the first we'd heard of this demo. Although I'd seen the equipment on their exhibit list, and I was like, well, I wonder what they're doing with that. I think they might be trying to demo. And we get over there, and it's really fast because they've got this old laptop, and they've got this little wireless transmitter that you'd sit in a room here, and they have these pagers, and they have this pager connected to a printer. And you type something over on the laptop, and you wait about 2 minutes. And sure enough, out comes on the pager and on the printer, this is your email that you just sent. And it looks somewhat like email. Now, there's some critical distinctions, and I won't bore you with those. But I sat down at the computer, and I was poking around a little bit, and their lawyers were looking right over my shoulder. And I saw that the files were from 1994, some of the ones they were working on. The critical date that they had to be before was about August 1990, when our guy invented it. So they were art, but they weren't prior art. And I'm sure they had to have noticed that I noticed that. Because the next day I drug our expert over and sat him down and pointed it out to them right in front of them. You know, that these dates are screwed up. And it was two files out of about 10 or 15 files on there. So we go back, and this is all before trial, and I tell the partners I'm working with, I'm like, oh, there's no way they're going to do this demo, or they're going to fix it, or something. Sure enough, that day, about halfway through trial, they put the guy on the stand who had done all this work. And he explained the system. And right before lunch, they timed it very well. Right before lunch, they had this snazzy little demonstration. And they ran it, and it worked great. And the jury was wowed. And they handed the page around to all the jury. And you could just see their face light up. And, you know, most of the people on our site fell a little bit down because this is a pretty effective demo. But over lunch, they finished that. I went up and checked the dates again on the computer they had set up in the courtroom. And the one file was still there that was from 1994, and it was the critical file. And the other one there had been entirely deleted. So we had objected when they started their demonstration. Our partner stood up and said, you know, Your Honor, we object. There's no foundation for this. And the judge actually got a little bit short with us and said, sit down, they're going to establish the foundation, which they did, kind of. We get up, and we have him step through all of the, go through his demo again, go through some of his files, and it turns out that he didn't put the demo together. Rim had put it together for him up in Canada, and he just ran it here. He hadn't really looked at the files. But he admitted that things like file sizes and file dates were like, and this was a quote, like DNA. And the partner got up and led him down the path, and the witness is up there smiling a lot, and sure enough, he sticks his head out just far enough, and our partner just whacks it off and says, can you come over here and talk about these dates? And he gets him over here, and he said, oh, gosh, I can't explain what this is with the 1994. I wasn't involved in this demo. What happened is I sent the files up to Canada, and the original files I sent were from 1990. Then they called me down and said they couldn't get those to work, and so I sent them a new batch of files, which was the 1994 files. This is all going on in front of the jury. And as soon as he admitted that, and he said, I can't explain the date, we moved to strike the demonstration. Room got up, objected. There was a big squabble in front of the jury. Judge sends the jury out. They start trying to explain what happened here with the jury. And it was a lot of kind of mealy-mouthed, and the judge wasn't buying it. And basically, he got so mad that he said, just be quiet, have to count to 10. And that's when you know things are going really well. He brings the jury back in, and he looks at him, and he's very stern, and he says, I think he might be a former Baptist minister. And he's very stern, very well-respected judge. And he said, I want you to disregard everything about that demo. It's gone. Take it out of your mind. And so they could pretty much guess what had gone on while they were out of the room. And that really, at that point, I don't think it would have mattered what we said before or after. They had been proven to try to lie or cheat the jury. And frequently in patent cases, juries aren't necessarily always the greatest with complex technology, but they're pretty good at telling who's lying and who's not. And that was really, from that point forward, it was downhill for them. At trial, the jury came back, obviously in our favor on everything, and gave a $23.1 million verdict in past damages, which was based upon a royalty rate of about 5.5%. The royalty rate was pretty interesting, and this is probably pretty typical in most cases. Our expert said 5.5% to 12%. Their expert said 1%, but it could range up to 6%. And you can see there's an overlap there of 5.5 to 6, and sure enough, jury came back in that range. No big surprise. Now, how does 23 million turn into 612? That's where this case gets interesting. Is because at this point, we had a jury verdict of infringement and validity in our favor against RIM's almost sole product. It was 90%+ of their business. Most companies would settle at that point. And in fact, we had given them, by this point, at least 3 separate settlement offers, including the day after their demonstration went south, we sent them a letter saying, here's our settlement terms. They didn't even respond to that one. So the judge, I think, at this point is flummoxed. Post-trial motions, he looks at everybody. He has a hearing in chamber, and he looks at everybody and he says, usually these cases settle once one side loses early on, and they had lost the claim interpretation phase. They had lost their 8 summary judgment motions. We won ours, or won. And they lost the verdict, and you would think that they'd be ready to settle. So he sends us into mediation, and I can't really talk about much about that, except that even at this point, where we had this jury verdict, where we're going to get attorney's fees, because after trial, the jury read their verdict and left, and he looked right at us and said, I'm assuming you're going to be filing your attorney's fees motion here soon, which is a pretty good hint you're going to get it. Our client has said that during this time frame, they would have been more than happy to settle the whole case or even sell the patents for $50 million. The 23.1 grows like crazy because of I'll come back to that. Just skip. They appeal up to the Federal Circuit. Something really strange happens up there. There's 2 panel opinions. The first one comes down in our favor just completely, 1 or 2 little issues. Second one, really strangely, they filed their petition for rehearing, and we didn't hear anything for a long time, from like December to August, and this is a long time for rehearing. And it turned out what they did was they bought RIM's argument on the the method claims. There were claims covering the components of the systems, and there were claims on the use of the method. And what they said was, for the method, you can't be doing a step outside the country. And so even though you can use the equipment that's up in Canada, you can't claim the actual step that you're doing up there. It's a very strange dichotomy, and I really think that it was a very weak distinction. And this is something you'll see. RIM, of course, appealed the losing issues that they lost on this territoriality thing up to the Supreme Court. We considered appealing these method claims, and I actually think that ruling is very subject to review. But since we had enough claims, didn't need it, we dumped that. RIM tried to go out and get a stay of a mandate from Chief Justice Roberts, and this was only a couple weeks after he was confirmed. And anyone will tell you that mandate states are very unusual.
Can you explain what that is?
I'm sorry. Yeah. It's once the Federal Circuit had ruled for us, basically sending it back down to the district court judge to consider the injunction. And the injunction is against pretty much the whole U.S. business. So this was a pretty concerning time for them. Because if Judge Spencer issues the injunction and they can't get that stayed or they can't get that reversed, then they basically have to shut down their U.S. business unless they find some alternative. Now, mandates, when you get a judgment from the Court of Appeals, the way the procedure works is once everything is finished up there, they issue what's called their mandate, which is really just their order to send it back down to the district court. And at that situation, you have a couple things you can do. You can appeal to the Supreme Court, which you can always do. But if you want to stop the district court from acting on it, you have to get either the appellate court or the Supreme Court to stay the mandate. It's enormously unusual. It's very unusual. But RIM made this big press splash. We're going to ask for the mandate to be stayed. Really built it up as though it was something that they were going to win. And, of course, the Chief Justice denied it. And it was this sequence, and this was all occurring in October 2005. And they had, every 2 weeks, there were three times, I guess it was right around the first week of October, the third week, and the last week of October, they had bad litigation losses here such that they had to hold the trading in their stock. And I'll bet that if you were a RIM shareholder, which I'm not, you're not real happy to see your stock keep getting halted on bad news. But part of it was just a concerted effort by them to constantly, I feel like, overplay their case. When you get out and you have your own clients, you'll learn real quickly that you always want to talk about how hard it is that you're a miracle worker if you actually win and stuff, and you never want to predict victory for your client, and that's what they kept doing. And then in January, the Supreme Court looked at their cert petition on the territoriality issue and denied cert. So that's for another day, I guess. But on the territoriality, which I'll just talk about real fast, the Federal Circuit opinion was fairly well-reasoned because there's a number of alternatives in the infringement statute: make, uses, or sells. And the Court of Appeals focused on uses. And their point was, and this was the example I kept hammering in every brief that we put to them and the Supreme Court, if you are standing on K Street in Washington, sending and receiving emails in your BlackBerry, where is the use of that occurring? I mean, it's clearly in the United States. You're not being, like, transported up to Canada during the interim of your message and then transported back down. And regardless of what you want to say for the other prongs, there was just no no way around that hypothetical. And they never really were able to deal with that. And the court pretty much bought off on that. Their analysis in the end was where you put beneficial use, where you put it into action. It doesn't seem like it should be that big of a question. I mean, everyone you speak to, layperson, is like, clearly I'm using this here. But it's one of those situations where if you really want to get into some sort of hyper-technical legal analysis, you could try to build a case for a big loophole in the U.S. law, which was clearly not intended. Okay, the interesting part. How does $23.1 million verdict turn into $612.5 million, my partners would always remind me to say, $1 million settlement. What had happened is in the post-trial arguments, when we asked for an injunction, they wanted to get a stay of the injunction pending appeal, which, of course, ideally we would like not to, but I think we recognized fairly early on that it's unlikely that a judge is going to issue an injunction shutting down a company's primary product when they haven't even had a chance to appeal. So we devised an alternative that we'd seen in one other kind of obscure case, which was that in exchange for a stay of the injunction pending appeal, they would escrow royalties during the appeal. RIM's growth exploded over that time. They went from 300,000 subscribers to 4 million users. And it came out at trial that they're getting somewhere on the order of $5 to $10 million, $5 to $10 a user per month. So the escrow account quickly swamped the jury verdict. By February of this year, when the most recent hearing was right before the settlement, there was $280 million accrued in escrow just for past damages.
That was just over a six-month span. It jumped from...
No, that was from... The $300,000 was November 2002 when the jury was, and the $4 million was, or roughly $4 million, was here by February 2006.
Okay, so it was 2002.
So at this point, there's this huge sum of money sitting in a bank in Richmond, and there's the patents don't expire until 2012. And I'm not sure how much y'all saw the press reports, but some of the analysts that covered RIM were just looking at their future growth expectations and doing a fairly simple discounted present value calculation for the next 6 years based on the research team royalty and coming up with settlement figures in the $1.5 billion range. And I can't remember whether it was Citibank or Merrill Lynch, but one of those two said that the worst case scenario would be $3 billion to settle this case. Which, you know, makes you quite very happy. Because NTP right now, there's about 20 investors. The largest two investors, or the largest two shareholders, were the family of the inventor and his good friend, the patent attorney, who had helped him through the last 15 years, invested in this and helped him with the patents. I said family of the inventor. Sadly, Mr. Campan had died. And it was the night before the argument at the Court of Appeals. And that, or actually the night after the argument. And by happenstance, the New York Times was running a story on him, and his picture was in the New York Times the day he died, which is not very, doesn't happen too frequently. But his family owns, you know, a big portion of the shares of MTP. So you have this context here where you have, in February, you get to the point where there's lots of briefing going on, and Judge Spencer sets a hearing date for the 27th where he's going to consider the injunction. And there's estimates, you know, ranging from, you know, $500 million up to, like I said, $3 billion. And rumors like crazy of settlement. I can't tell you the number of times, probably a half a dozen days in November, December, January, where I'm sitting in my desk, and within 15 minutes, I get maybe 60, 70 calls because somebody had put out a rumor of settlement and people were calling to confirm. And I'd pull up my little web browser or whatever, and RIMSTOCK would either have jumped up, you know, a whole bunch, or jumped down a whole bunch. And it really was an interesting view for me to see how little people on Wall Street actually know about what's going on. It makes me really not want to invest my money there at all. I really just, we can talk about that a little bit more in the questions if you want, but how shockingly inaccurate both investment analyst reports and frequently press reports were on the case. Just surprising. It was very surprising to me. Anyway, at this point, February 2006, up to now, you know, RIM had pretty much, in our view, refused to settle. There had been some discussions about a year before, including the signing of a one-page term sheet. And I can't go into too many details, but ultimately Judge Spencer determined that that term sheet was too vague to be enforceable. That was for $450 million. During the course of that year, obviously, NTP's position had become much better. No, the Supreme Court said no. We won the Court of Appeals. So the price was going to be higher. And, you know, you can see you've got $280 million bank for past damages, and you've got ranges up to $3 billion. It's going to be hard to come together. Eventually, after Judge Spencer at the hearing was very stern, and I'm not sure if you saw the press reports, but he let the lawyers ramble on. He's very polite. He lets everybody stand up and ramble on. He asked a few questions, but in the end, he gave a very, basically a stern warning where he chewed out pretty much both parties and said, look, you know, you guys should settle this. You're leaving it to the court. I'm going to give you, you know, that's going to result in an imperfect solution, and I'm going to give you that imperfect solution. And both sides went away, thought about that a little bit, had a meeting the next week, and reached a dollar figure and terms. I mean, it hadn't, but the year before, the $450 million term sheet didn't break down over money. It broke down over terms. And unfortunately, I can't really go into that because some of that was under some mediation privilege. But it was widely reported that it broke down over various terms, which, as you would expect, a $450 million settlement that's reflected on really half a page of paper, not likely to be complete. This is something I figured you all probably want to talk about, the injunctions, because it's widely in the news. The normal rule is a patent owner gets an injunction after winning. And there's one exception that has been recognized for the last however many years, and it's the public welfare. And it stems from this famous case, Milwaukee Sludge, where basically the judge said, look, I'm not going to let you shut down the sewer system and dump a bunch of sewage into Lake Michigan. So you're not going to get an injunction in this situation. But in pretty much every other case, I'm going to give you an injunction. Now, that is up for the Supreme Court right now, because in the eBay case, also in the Eastern District of Virginia here, down in Norfolk, Judge Friedman, he said to the patentee there, I'm not going to give you an injunction. And he had a number of reasons, but two of them were reasons that I didn't think made very much sense. First of all, he said, I'm not going to give you an injunction because we'll just have a whole bunch of contempt hearings after that, which to not give relief because somebody might come in and actually try and enforce that relief seems a little strange. And then he also said, also I've seen lots of commentators out there talk about how bad business method patents are, and I don't think they're very good, so I'm not going to give you an injunction on those guys. And that case goes up to the Federal Circuit, and Judge Bryson, that I had the chance to clerk for back in 2000 and 2001, wrote an opinion overturning that and saying, no. The rule really is, you know, once somebody's won, patent rights are property right. The Constitution calls for the exclusive right there. And so unless it's one of these public welfare situations, you need to give an injunction. And eBay successfully petitioned the Supreme Court for cert. The case was heard, I think, not last week, but the week before. If you're interested, I have the transcript, so you can email me. But it'll be interesting to see how it comes out, because there's a real question. There's issues of fairness on both sides. If you have somebody that doesn't practice their patent, should they be able to shut down somebody that is? I think ultimately the Supremes are going to affirm Judge Bryson. He's pretty widely respected. I think he worked at the Solicitor General's office with Chief Justice Roberts. And I think his reasoning is pretty sound. But there's lots of action in Congress where money speaks about limiting the injunctive right for patentees. And it's a very interesting alignment there. You have a lot of tech companies against injunctions, a lot of big companies, because, well, RIM's a good example. When they were a small company, they successfully sued on their patents and shut out a number of other companies. But once they got big and got market power, it's more fun to use your market power than it is your patents. And but on the other side, opposing changes to the injunction, which means permitting people to still get injunctions as a matter of course, are the universities and big pharma. And the universities have this, and small inventors, but the universities have a similar incentive. They invent all this stuff, and then they license it out to somebody, so they're not actually practicing the patents themselves. Big pharma doesn't want changes to the injunction because injunctions are how they use to keep that's what they use to keep the generic drugs out of the market. And so if there is any weakening of the right to injunctions, I think Big Pharma is probably afraid that you'll have a situation where a judge says, well, normally you're entitled to an injunction, but it's... Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I'm just a bit confused. I think I just don't know the answer to this. Doesn't the whole point of settling to avoid the question of an injunction?
That's right. And that, in this case, it did get avoided. That's the only thing that it avoided. Well, Judge Spencer hadn't issued his ruling yet, but there was clearly pressure on both sides. The pressure on RIM was that he was going to issue an injunction. The pressure on NTP was that he might not. And if he issued an injunction, RIM had said that they had ways to work around it, but it was clearly going to be very disruptive to their business. If he said he wasn't going to issue the injunction, then NTP faced the possibility of litigating for the next 5 or 6 years trying to get recovery on this.
And RIM's argument against the injunction was the public welfare one?
Yes. I don't know. I don't know how much this made the press. I think quite a bit, though. But basically, they came in and said, the whole U.S. economy depends upon blackberries. And it sounds funny, but I am not kidding you. That's what they said. And they put in a stack of affidavits about this high from people that used blackberries during Katrina, and they used blackberries 9/11. They used blackberries, at their hospital. They put in an economic analysis. Do you know Arthur Laffer? We did the Laffer curve, very famous. They hired him. He came out with an economic analysis, said something like, I can't remember. I have to go look, but I want to say that blackberries meant something like $50 billion, or maybe it was more, to the U.S. economy. So if Judge Spencer issued an injunction, he was going to chop off just a huge amount of the U.S. economy, which, if we'd ever have to go to trial again, we're going to bring him in as our damages person to talk about how much damages we should get here, right? But that was their defense. And they had the Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security, actually there was the Department of Justice representing several governmental entities that intervened seeking to say, don't shut down blackberries. Now, the strange thing, there's some very strange things about that. They had originally tried to do this back in 2003 when Judge Spencer made his first ruling. And what RIM did then was 2 months after trial, they troop up to Capitol Hill and they meet with one of the congressmen up there, Bob Ney, whose name you might have seen involved in the Abramoff scandal. Although I don't know if there's any connection, I'm just mentioning that. But they meet with him, and he's the chairman of the House Administration Committee. And this is all according to the Washington Post, so this is not anything not public. He gets the House Administrator to write a letter to Judge Spencer saying, please don't shut down our blackberries. Now, this is really funny for a number of reasons. First of all, had they just gone and looked at the statutes that Congress itself passed, you can't get an injunction against the government use. They are the sovereign. There's a special statute that says you cannot enjoin U.S. government usage. But they didn't take the time to do that. Second, it seems a little offensive to have the House come in and try to interfere with a judiciary action. We need real separation of powers issues here. In fact, about a month later when Judge Spencer we had the hearing on the injunction, he gave a quote which we quoted several times in our subsequent pleadings, and which I really felt like summed up his subsequent view of the case. And he said, my courtroom is one of the last places on earth where power, money, and political influence don't mean a damn thing. And when he was saying that, he wasn't looking at little MGP. And that really is what happened after trial. I mean, RIM, they did a good job of appeal. They faced an uphill battle then, but they started a blitz of PR and lobbying up on the Hill. And we really did, to be honest, we didn't really even know the full extent of it until just the last couple months after it had been going on for some reason. Go ahead.
The statutes that you can't enjoin government usage, are those the reason why the public welfare kind of defense had to be based on an economic?
Yes. Like? Yes. They had originally tried it 3 years ago. They attempted, during the first briefing on the injunction, they attempted to say, you're going to shut down the government. That's public welfare. And we got up and said, well, Your Honor, first of all, we can't shut down the U.S. government. Second, there's questions about whether we can even shut down the state governments because of federalism issues there. But it doesn't matter. We are not going to enforce the injunction against any sort of government, state, local, police, whatever. And we said that pretty much because, one, those users are a small subset of RIM's customer base, and two, we don't want to be the bad guys. And three, it kind of wiped out the argument then. And then they're left with asserting, and I mentioned some of these affidavits. I think there were ones from Wall Street, RIM's lawyers, Skadden Arps, at the very last moment, came in and filed an affidavit saying, woe will fall upon Wall Street and us and bankers and lawyers and everything if we get enjoined. And that was a reflection, a response to kind of our philosophy at the very end here is that, yeah, fine, you know, hospitals and legitimate public welfare, we have no problem with them using. But let's be honest here. The vast majority of BlackBerry users are investment banks and law firms and Fortune 500 companies. And that's what we went after in our pleadings.
I have two questions about the facts of the case and,
sure,
and
sure.
One question. So about the facts of the case, I just want to wind the settlement thing. So the social value of the system is $15 billion, and estimates of value is up to $3 billion. So why didn't NTP and RIM, agree on, say, percentage sharing, so I don't know, 10% royalties going forward, which, that's just about the business of NTP.
Sure.
Risk. That's one question. The second question is, I remember in the last phase of the litigation, RIM had this patch that they said is ready
yes.
for download that would basically evade them,
yeah.
the infringement. So was that, or so if it was really that way, why couldn't they just
sure.
protect themselves from future infringement?
Sure.
What was it like? The last question is, I was intrigued by your comments about how the patent system tends to help small patentees, giving them power against the big ones, which try to stifle innovation by just leveraging their market power, and they basically rest on their laurels and they don't innovate. Because there's another argument, just the opposite, that some people
Absolutely.
Just question whether the patent system really helps the little guy or the big guy. So, and the best example would be say IBM just, patenting whatever they can, building a patent thing
yeah.
and basically preventing any future innovation by the little guys.
Yeah.
So what's your take on this?
Okay, if I can remember them, I'll go through your questions here. The first one was why essentially was there a paid-up settlement, $612.5 million, rather than the continuing the royalty rate? Because the jury had said 5.7, and that was certainly one option. Had we not got the injunction, and had we not settled, that's exactly what had been, and that was what is commonly referred to as a forced royalty. I forget the term of art. But anyway, that would have been a forced royalty for the term of the patent. Compulsory license.
Right.
That's it. They do that in Europe. They do that in Canada. U.S. does not do that. But had he denied the injunction, that's the situation we'd have been in. And there's a strong argument to be made that we'd ended up with a boatload more money. Because if you look at their growth,
right.
and we were accruing that $280 million just right now was going up by, what was it, $12 million a month. So if you project that out with no growth in RIM's business for 6 years, it was going to be a lot of money. I don't know for sure why the parties, it's ultimately the parties that get to decide that, but there's a number of reasons why the parties would not have wanted to do that. First of all, from the NTP side, they wanted their money. Like I said, the inventor, Tom Campana, died. Another investor in NTP who had been around, involved in it for a long time, had died just a couple months before. A bird in the hand is return of the bird. Really, it boiled down to that. There's lots of things that could happen there. I think from RIM's perspective, they probably would have been unhappy to have such an arrangement for a couple reasons. But primarily, it's that they wanted to just get this out of their hair. Along with the compulsory license comes auditing rights. I don't think that RIM, this litigation is enormously bitter from NTP's standpoint. I think they felt like RIM was a big bully. From RIM's standpoint, from day one, they say NTP is undeserving. It's a small company. They don't deserve patent rights. There was a lot of bitterness on both sides. I don't think either side, NTP didn't want to have to be trooping up to Canada every 3 months to do an audit. RIM didn't want NTP coming up and looking through their books every 3 months. And I guarantee you, Judge Spencer did not want the parties back down beforehand every 3 months arguing about royalties. So I think it's just a compromise. Your second question was... the patch. Yeah. They said they had this workaround, but they were giving conflicting messages. Their CEO was quoted in the Washington Post. It's just a quick flick of the switch. You know, we'll just do it. Nobody will even notice it. In their court filings, and when they stood up before Judge Spencer, they said, oh gosh, it will cost us hundreds of dollars per user. It's going to cost us hundreds of millions of dollars to implement this. And also in their court filings, they said, if we do implement it, there's going to be problems for users. Some of the users are going to leave us. And ultimately, I don't know exactly what it was, but I don't think it got around the patents. And I think what they were doing there was taking a chance, they're using it for negotiating leverage, and they were hoping that if they implemented it, it would be enough of a change so that we couldn't capture it in a contempt hearing and we had to do another trial. And so they buy themselves 5 more years. So I still don't know exactly what the workaround was, but I'm 99% certain that we would not have believed it to be an actual workaround. And your third question was? Large companies, yeah. I mean, I don't want you to get the impression that I'm just a shrill for small companies, because, to be honest, we represent a wide gamut. We're exactly on the opposite side of the issue now in a case where we represent Verizon against a small company that is seeking damages on all of Verizon's nationwide DSL service patent. So I understand both sides of the argument there. Ultimately, I don't think there's going to be a lot that gets done in the patent system. It helps both small people and large people, and there are some tweaks that can be done to it. But like I was explaining, there's so many different interests that you have to address there that, you know, I'm not sure anything's going to be done. And I don't know whether, you're right, I mean, the IBMs of the world go in and get 50 billion patents, and, you know, a big company might come to you, and I'm not saying IBM does this, but a big company might come to you and say, you infringe my patents. I want you to pay me $1 million a year in royalties. And you pay all your lawyers all this money, and you come back and say, okay, we've looked at the patents that you've said that we infringe on, and we don't infringe them. That's entirely different from what we do. And the big company might just turn to you and smile and say, okay, you've looked at these 10. Now look at these other 10,000 that we have there, and we're sure that you infringe on one of those. And just the transaction cost of evaluating all of those is frequently more than what you're being asked to pay royalties on. And that actually brings out a good point that I didn't mention, that during the damages trial, RIM's damages expert, who was up there trying to minimize the value of patents, was a man named Richard Donaldson. in his former life, he was in charge of the licensing program for Texas Instruments. The last several years he was at Texas Instruments, their largest business was their licensing. They were getting $1 billion a year in licensing revenues from their patents. They weren't even producing the products on it. Not exactly the best person put forward as a licensing expert trying to minimize the amount that patents are the value. Can you get him up there on the stand? Like, you know, let's go through what you've done. So, anyway, did I get all three?
I had read a funny anecdote, I don't know if it's just my life, but in the closing hours of the final film, I guess it was late at night in a New York hotel and or an office building, and the floors got locked somehow, and the way that the two parties could communicate with each other was their blacker.
I actually don't know a whole lot about, or I can't say a whole lot about that. I'd be surprised, though. It's possible. I don't really want to talk about those last hours. I'll say that I wasn't there. That was the only substantive thing in this whole case. I didn't go up for them because, to be honest, I didn't think it was going to go anywhere. And I have a 10-month-old son, and since I have a son, I don't like to travel. And they went up there, and even the senior partner that went up there to handle this, Jim Wallace, he didn't take any clothes with him. So he ended up, like, laundering and buying new. Ultimately, when they reached the settlement, I think the client paid for him to buy the garage, give it a suit or something. But that's possible. They were at a couple. I think they started off at Citibank, and they were also at Skin at that time. But I can't confirm it.
Can you talk about? I know that some of the patents are being challenged.
Sure. The re-exam. Yeah. Actually, let me make sure. I've got a video here. And maybe what I'll do is I'll answer your question and I'll play the video because I think it's really funny. And I know you guys probably have places to go. After trial, okay, there's a procedure at the patent office called reexamination, which basically means after the patents have been issued, somebody takes documents, and it has to be documents, back in and says, okay, the patents are not valid, patent claims are not valid because here's somebody that did it first. And if you do, reexamination can be very useful if you do it in the early stages of the litigation, because you can go to the judge and you can say, Your Honor, why waste all your time with this trial? Let's let the experts at the patent office look at it first. And then if they decide the patents are valid, then that removes a major issue from the case. RIM didn't do that. They waited until after they lost the jury verdict. Then they went in secretly and were finding all sorts of interesting things out. About 2 months ago, we put in a FOIA, a Freedom of Information Act request to the Patent Office. And we're finding all sorts of interesting communications that we're not sure are quite kosher. But they started doing this re-exam. And you're supposed to do a re-examination for litigation with special dispatch, which, if you know anything about the patent office, things move at a usually sometimes slow pace over there. And special dispatch is supposed to mean faster. And so that was about January 2003. Okay, so it gets to February 2004. And we're still in the appellate phase. The patent office has done nothing. And as part of our response in the reexaminations, we put into the patent office a declaration from the inventor, Tom Campion, which we thought addressed many of the issues there. And he was a valuable resource because he was around at that time. We called the patent office and said, okay, you haven't done anything for the last 13 months. Can you look at his affidavit and tell us if you're going to need more? Because we just found out that he has esophageal cancer. Like, okay, yeah, we're gonna do that. We've got it ready to go. We're gonna send something out, a response out next week. We call them next week. Please, Our veteran is definitely ill. Please do something. They do nothing. They do nothing. He dies a couple months later. And then about 6 months after that, that's when they start spitting stuff out. And some of the rejections that they spit out, all but say, if Tom Campana were here to do an affidavit, this rejection would be withdrawn, but he's dead, he's not here, you can't cure the problem. It's a very unsympathetic position for them to be in. As it stands now, all of the patents are under re-exam, all of the claims have been rejected, preliminarily. The procedure over there is there's initial office actions with the examiner, and then it goes up to an appellate board in the patent office, and then it goes back up to the Federal Circuit, which has already ruled during the litigation phase that the patents were not invalid. We'll see what happens. We had a meeting last week. I think we presented some pretty compelling arguments. I think if need be, we get up to the Federal Circuit and the patent office can get overturned.
If they hadn't validated them and you hadn't settled, would that have wiped away everything?
It's interesting. There's conflicting case law on that. And the patent office has taken the position in previous reexaminations that patents are fully enforceable during the pendency of reexam. They pretty much have to take that because otherwise you can eliminate somebody's patent rights by just shoving them into re-exam. The time of the patent expires and then what are you going to do? But had the case not settled and the re-exam gone all the way up to the Federal Circuit and they affirmed the patent office so that patents were ultimately declared invalid, it's very possible that the entire judgment and settlement, if the case is still going on at that time, would be wiped out. Now, once it's settled, then the case law is very strong that once you settle and if at some point in the future your patents are declared invalid, you don't get to claw back money. That's just a standard kind of res judicata theory. But yeah, it could have happened. And that was another reason why the number was closer to 280 million than 3 billion. You find it out. It was poorly severed. The second clip, the shorter clip, at the time we're playing that, we have got blown up in a huge poster board and on the screens a quote from a press release. And we're saying, we were literally reading their exact language saying you can't stay on top of your wireless email with BlackBerry. And we had the full page ad in the Post and the Journal. I mean, this was astounding to me. You see, it was August, so it was 2 months before trial. And I don't know if you noticed, it was 9:15 a.m. I mean, we started at 9. And it was already a long day for me at that point. The guy you heard talking was Jim Wallace, the partner I worked with. And I was feeding him all this stuff, and finally, he pretty much just turns to me and says, okay, we're going to get nowhere with this guy. Let's just bring out stuff and let him hang himself with his own girl. And sure enough, he did, because we played these two clips in front of the jury, and especially that first one, because that's the way the pixels are arranged. The jury had the same response that you had. They laughed at it. And this, when we played this, was when he was up on the stand trying to make the defense. It was crazy. I mean, that was really, I just didn't understand that. And we had a couple other good clips, but these were the best, so we played these at trial.
How would you have tried to, you know, I guess, lawyer the case if you were that? I mean, what do you think is their biggest mistake?
Not settling early on. Because they really, I think they, client's been quoted, even before trial, they could have probably got out of this case for somewhere between 0 and 50 million. That's a lot closer to 0 than 50. And they ended up spending supposedly 40 or more million dollars. I don't know, that's what press reports have said, just on litigation fees. There were things, I don't really know if there was a winning case to be had on your side. there was certainly not a case that if their case was so bad, if they were my client, and this is after 90% of my client's business is still intact, I don't think that I would have let them get into this position. It's easy to say. I mean, because the people on the other side were not stupid. They're very skilled lawyers, but some of the best firms in the country. I mean, Jones Day, Howery, at the end, they had Howard Rice, they had McKenna. Those were people at the trial, but they had very good legal representation, and I just don't know. The question that you kind of are implying there is why didn't they settle? And if I had a penny for every time somebody called me up on the phone, a reporter or an analyst, saying, why have these guys settled? And I had to say, I'd be, which I'm not. So.
I don't know if you can answer this, but how did you and your partners go find a select jury for
The jury selection was myself and the senior partner, Jim Wallace, which really was, I mean, I was just a second year associate then, and I got to pretty much second chair. I mean, we had two partners that tried the case, and we had through a couple other partners and lots of associates that were with us. But so we sat down, jury selection, you don't get a whole lot of information about them. You get, I believe, their background. I think you get their addresses and names. But we didn't do anything like hire jury consultants. It was pretty much a gut feeling.
Did you want people that were potentially more tech savvy, or people that really didn't know?
It didn't really make a difference, I don't think, because I don't think the jury pool had a lot. I mean, it didn't have a lot of the software engineers on it. That wasn't one of the criteria. I don't think we struck very many jurors. The other side used their full, except maybe one, the full selection of challenges. But we were pretty happy just with, we felt that we had a very sympathetic story and that we were going to come forward with common sense presentation to the jury. And we really felt like their presentations were ones that weren't going to work for a jury. They were just not, I don't know what the word is, but I just never found them compelling. It's one of those things where you might have 10 arguments that are 40% winners, and you know what? Those end up with a zero winner. I mean, you need one argument that's at least a 51% winner, and they just never could get one. So when we got down to the jury, we felt actually very confident.
In terms of the settlement, it was the $613 million.
Yeah.
And then it's for the remainder of the patent, which the patent runs through 2012, did NTP license it for the duration?
Yeah. They've got a paid-up license.
Okay. And then there's no royalty going forward.
No royalty going forward.
For reasons you said before. This is great, but I know this is what you're trying to do.
Yeah, sure, if you guys can just go ahead and
You mentioned a bunch of different firms that worked with RIM on this. Were they handling different appeals, or what was the breakdown?
Jones Day handled the trial along with their local counsel in Richmond. I can't remember. They're a very well-renowned firm. The appeal was primarily handled by Howery. And then once it got to the Supreme Court stage and the final settlement stage, that's when McKenna came in to do most of the Supreme Court stuff, apparently. I mean, you never really know over here on our side who was doing what, but and Howard Rice did a lot of the stuff the second most recent time down at the district court and consummated the settlement.
Okay.
You said Skadden, too.
Skadden is RIM's corporate counsel.
Oh.
And they were advising them, apparently, on securities issues. I don't know exactly the full details of their relationship. They weren't involved in the litigation directly. But they had a slew of people. And I think they might have had a lot of law firms across the world searching for prior art, because there were a few times when we contacted law firms, it really wasn't even about this, just to ask them questions. And we basically got a, we can't speak to you, which usually indicates that they have a conflict or something like that. So they put a lot of money and effort in you, as you would expect.
Did RIM have any related patents to the Black Dragon?
Oh, they got lots. They got tons of them.
Were you guys attacking the validity of
that? No, because, well, we didn't need to, because our patents all had a critical date of 1990, a filing date of 1991, uh-huh. And their patents really didn't start rolling out until 98, 99, so the fact that they had their own patents was irrelevant.
So those were just different aspects of technology.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's funny, you saw Mr. Lazaridis say, oh, I didn't design the system. Not me, it's not my company. But there's a patent that they have which covers their system. At least when they got it, they announced that it covered the system. And he's the leading bidder on it. And so, he's a brilliant guy. And I think he was ill-served here. He deserves better than to look like this in front of a jury. It's very smart. Any other questions?